House Committee on Revenue for March 1st, 2018 will come to order. Colleagues, today we have an information meeting on the tax gap with analytics. I think we're going to hear a very interesting set of presentations today. I'm hoping that other members will wander in. Everyone had caucus at noon, and there are other committees meeting at which some of our members are gone for, so they won't be here. So why don't you come up and give your presentation? We'd love to have it. And if you state your name for the record and then tell us what you're going to tell us, we'd love to hear that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sarah Gates with the SAS Institute, and I want to thank you for having us here today to talk to you about how you can leverage analytics to reduce the tax gap. With me, I have Carl Hammersberg. And before we get started on our presentation, I just wanted to give you a couple-minute overview of who SAS is and why are we here and why are we relevant to this conversation. So we're the largest software company you've never heard of, probably. We have been around for 42 years. We focus solely on helping organizations leverage their data. You've heard the term analytics used in the media all the time today, and we're one of the founders of that whole approach to analyzing data. We work with clients around the world, and governments is our second largest group of clients. And particularly in the government space, what we really like to help focus on is how do we help governments deliver on their mission. One of those areas would be how do you protect, identify, and collect revenue for the state. And so that's what we're here to talk to you about today. And now I'd like to let Carl talk to you a little bit more specifically about it. Carl?
Thank you.
Well, before he starts, let me just say that last sentence got my attention.
Excellent. Hopefully we can hold it for a while.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, want to thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, I'm Carl Hammersberg with SAS. And yes, really want to talk a little bit about analytics as they stand today. Want to start so that you understand a little bit of my background. I've worked with tax now in many different states over the course of 26 years, but really my background came from 20 years working around tax in Washington State, the majority of that with the Department of Labor and Industries, which oversaw our state-run exclusive workers' compensation system, so a multi-billion dollar tax that we were bringing in every year to cover that. Really, we looked like a combination of DCBS along with some other pieces that you have here. During my time there, I also worked extensively with the legislature over the course of a few years with an underground economy joint legislative task force that was there as we really started to tackle around the various issues that hit all of our taxing programs within the state, started to look at how can we all improve, how can we work together, how can we do the right things, do the smart things, get a better return on investment. And one of the side things that we did as part of that was teaming up and really starting to look at a study. We actually called it the Unregistered Business Study, but ultimately we ended up looking at both unregistered businesses as well as ones that were underreporting, and found that just from that aspect of a tax perspective, we were looking at a $1.4 billion gap every biennium. So started to really take a look at what's the size and scope of the potential problem that we might be working with.
Now, your slide there shows Washington State.
That is correct.
Is this the Washington State number or an Oregon number?
That was the Washington State number.
Thank you.
Yes. So, in really looking at things today, what I want to do is set out the perspective of the things that are already being done here and in many other places from departments of revenue and how we're starting to look at risks these days. And typically, a lot of things had been sort of high volume, low dollar, you know, starting to look at that. That's where things like doing the IRS offset program, where we really start to be able to collect funds from them based on monies that we're owing there to bring in monies to the state. It's a great multi-million dollar program, brings in a lot of revenue every single year with very little effort. That's fantastic. That helps deal with mistakes, people that couldn't pay. And then you start to look at core business systems, audit rules, matching, those kinds of things. That really helps for the folks that were taking sort of an opportunistic view of it. Like, all right, I'm going to try underreporting my taxes. Let's see how this goes. But as you start to get to, exactly. But as you start to really get at things these days, a lot has changed. And so things are becoming much more premeditated. That's where we've seen people that are start to work with identity proofing. So the idea there is really purchasing third-party data entities to be able to combine that with government data to really start to say, are you really who you say you are? Can you answer those questions about you lived in this county and owned this car in that year? Well, some of the risks of those approaches is all the data breaches that have happened to all of us over the course of the years, and I'll focus on that in a bit here. And then really start to look at the idea of that more advanced analytics starts to help when you look at complex schemes, coordinated schemes, start to really think about things having to do with identity theft, looking at networks of issues. So, to just throw a few numbers at you there, I don't know if any of you have been notified of data breaches in your own life. I know I've had a number of them. As a matter of fact, almost every single company that's listed on here, I've been notified that I was one of the people that was a victim of their data breach. Obviously, Equifax is one of the biggest, most recent, and apparently this morning they found another few tens of millions of people that turns out were breached. So that's always a good one to kind of keep in the news there. And one in four people that are notified of a data breach end up being a victim of identity theft in one way, shape, or form. That's over 12 million a year, and that's been increasing over the course of recent years. But one of the things that has really changed is how often that's now being used, not just for things like taking over credit cards, taking over bank accounts, but actually using it for government fraud. So that's become that number one piece. 43% of the time in what's being reported to the Federal Trade Commission is actually government-related fraud. And so that's turned not just benefits programs, where a lot of that might be used in, let's say, unemployment benefits or for Medicaid, but it's actually turned those of us in tax programs that always thought of it as a tax into an unintended benefits program. Here's people that are trying to use those stolen identities as a way to gain money from the states. So, a way to really think about that differently is turning it on its head and how you look at it. So, a typical approach, and that a lot of states have used very effectively, is to really build up an audit engine, a rules engine. How do we compare things? How do we look within individual returns and start to identify the things that show risk? It's that same type of thing that if you were looking at your federal reports and filings, and if you're using one of the online systems, they might tell you, here's what your audit risk looks like, based on the types of things you're doing, how much you're deducting, that kind of thing. Those are very sort of typical rules-based things. But it's looking at individual people, and it's looking at individual returns. So that event could be, I'm filing a return right now. Let's take a look at it. And then looking at a single individual. And really the idea with analytics is starting to move past that point of rules. Everything's not black or white. There's a whole range of risks depending on behavior. And starting to look at the idea of multiple years worth of returns and potentially multiple people. And to really start to see behaviors over time that, and being able to look for those anomalies. In one of those cases, with identity theft, you could look different from yourself. I have a way that I've typically filed my returns over past years. If I always filed late and I had a certain pattern of the deductions and suddenly it's coming in early with very different numbers, that alone is a trigger that says you don't look like yourself. So that's one way of looking at anomalies. The second thing is then comparing me to everyone else that look like my peers and seeing where that behavior looks off. And starting to combine those things in different ways to really be able to look at it collectively. And there's no reason that you want to get rid of rules. There's good ones. Hey, this person's been dead for 3 years. Why are they suddenly filing for a refund? Okay, that's a pretty good rule. You want to keep things like that in place. And you want to do those data matches. You want government talking to government. I've always been a big proponent of that. But starting to really think past that, starting to look at those multiple years and multiple returns. So I'm going to start with a real simple example. We'll do a couple of different ones here. So a couple of years ago, you had taxpayer Bill Henderson, and he was filing claiming a dependent. So he's claiming his child. And you can see the rest of the stuff there used to prepare. Here's, and he actually owed tax. Next year, the child appears, but now is being claimed as a dependent by the mother. Okay, very reasonable. We can see the connection there. Again, you start to take a look. There's some earned income tax credits, small refund. You can, again, take a look at the filing dates. Now all of a sudden for the 2017 year, you have that same child being claimed by a completely different person. Neither the mother, neither the mother nor the father, and you start to see a significant, also seeing those other sorts of things, that earned income tax credit, looking at the refund, no prepare, very early filing date. So at times it's not just about filing the actual return under a stolen identity, it's taking those stolen identities and putting them under other returns. It's putting those other connections together. And it's only by looking across multiple factors, multiple years, multiple returns. None of these are the same taxpayer. And so if you looked at a single year, or if you looked even at a single taxpayer over the course of multiple years, you wouldn't identify this issue cropping up. And that's really that idea of sort of thinking about things more collectively, thinking about them different, and looking at them from analytics.
So I assume you're going to tell us a little bit about how you do that.
I'm certainly happy to kind of dive into some of the details of how we do different things from an analytics standpoint. Yes.
Let me back up.
Yes, of course.
I'm assuming that the information that you need in order to get these three returns in the same pile, so you can look at them, is already available. It's just a matter of digging it out of either the returns or some other information that you have.
So thank you, Chair Barnhart. Yes, that would be the answer. Is in that last case, every single bit of this data would already be within the Department of Revenue systems, would already be within the filings that they had. So they didn't need to look externally necessarily for this piece. Some analytical approaches take data from other government agencies, or typically, you know, very often it's also combining the IRS data like they're doing, so it's looking at some of the federal returns as well as what's going on at the state level. That can help when the schemes basically started where past years were other states, so you might not have had that return, but being able to start to take a look at it.
Right. But, I mean, the reason I ask the question is that for this example, at least, we don't need any statutory changes.
No.
They've already got the data. There are situations in which, depending upon what data you want, we might have to have statutory changes to allow departments to share data that they don't now share. That's the reason I asked the question. Yeah. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Of course. And nothing that I would talk about today specifically would require any statutory changes or necessarily data from other departments. So that can definitely be a whole separate issue. I've done a lot around data sharing and those kinds of things, and could certainly, if you have questions, can address that as well. So another example, and just kept this one really simple in terms of the graphic standpoint, but it's starting to, again, look at things analytically. So how do you compare things that don't seem related? So in one of the analytical approaches that we use is called geoboxing. And so in this case, we're looking at things that are in a relatively similar area, though not necessarily taking it to a specific zip code level or something else that's predefined, but really starting to look at this idea of it's in a relative geographic area. And what this helped us do was identify where a single individual had found a particular scheme in the way that they decided to cheat on their taxes, and then started sharing that scheme with, guess what, neighbors. So these folks look completely unrelated. They're not family. In a lot of cases, they're not even on the same street, but they're all relatively similarly close together. We were able to uncover an entire network of scheme around this just by looking at them geographically. Another one, this same type of approach, it actually came back to, turns out they were all in the same country club together. And that was the way that they were sharing things. At other times, it's looking at a lot of returns around an individual employer. So again, that idea of how do these things happen? How is there, how could there be a connection? Now, most of that data, the country club data wouldn't necessarily have appeared in it. That kind of came out as the investigation was done. But all the rest of this, the data is already in the systems. So that whole point, as you were already addressing, it's there, it's data they have. It's just looking at it differently, it's looking at it analytically, and it's not predefining an individual return, an individual person that you're looking at, starting to think about it a little bit more collectively. One of the states that's really gone down this route is North Carolina. And in that particular case, they've actually, now there they did do some statutory changes that had to do with being able to create a central data analytics center and some data sharing that occurred across a lot of different agencies. And so there's different analytic pieces that are going on with, let's say, their unemployment folks, with Medicaid, with other programs there. But they decided to use that as a central place to be able to start building out analytics on top of a brand new core system. So one of the best things that revenue agencies can do is upgrade their main systems. Oregon has already done that. We've gone with Gentax, which is one of the leaders, one of the other ones out there, Revenue Solutions. I've worked with both of them, I've seen them. And so that's a great first step. And then you can layer analytics on top of that. They really wanted to improve their detection of identity theft, as well as identify audit candidates that they should be taking a look at. Their first step was really just bringing the analytics into their own core systems, and then started to enhance it to be able to take a look at both individual returns, started there, and then onto business returns. Definitely saw a significant improvement over just their core system with the rules and the audit flags that they already had in place, and then built out a full analytics interface. So they're now starting to see a lot of savings in terms of time on cases as well. So not only the ability to detect more, to find things sooner, quicker, better, but also be able to reduce the amount of time that's spent on individual audits. They've seen a positive return on investment in each of their phases to the tune of multi-million dollars. Wanted to give just a completely sort of different example of in this case, a Midwestern state, and really started with the fact that they were doing a lot of reviews for the problems that they were finding. So in their baseline year, so this idea of false positives, when you have rules, everything's black or white. So coming back to that theme there. And so in their baseline year, they reviewed over 23,000 cases to find 4,600 bad returns, which means they had over 18,000 false positives. One of the first things that we took a look at was, can we layer analytics on top of those rules and just find a way to get you efficiencies around that? And so there's different points along the curve that you could choose, but one of the example points that we gave would have basically still found 3,800 of those returns just from that particular methodology, while reducing the number of cases from 23,000 to 8,000. So suddenly you're getting back two-thirds of the time from those staff to be able to go work on completely different analytic runs. So a 73% reduction of false positives. What they saw then from going past that pilot to the full project was, again, not only getting rid of all those false positives, but by having all this data, by being able to see multiple years returns at one place at one time, by being able to look at networked issues, they actually then also doubled the number of cases the same amount of staff were able to review. So significant reduction of false positives. Those are returns you're not holding up. Those are taxpayers you're not annoying, which I always consider a very good outcome in terms of things. And again, they saw a very significant improvement in terms of the dollars. The IRS, and I know that's kind of a hard one to mention, definitely much maligned, though I did get my tax return in a week this year, so that was good. File early, definitely beat the identity thieves out there. But they are trying to deal with identity theft, and they're significantly working on that, also dealing with issues around what they're calling ghost preparers, this idea of either people that are acting as tax preparers but not declaring themselves, those kinds of issues. And they've been dealing with staffing cuts year after year. And so there, they really turned it into an integrated analytics platform. They have analyses running every single day on all those returns, completing all the analytical analyses intraday. And on the peak days, over 13 million returns. So the point is, you don't have to slow up processing to be able to do the right thing. Because that's often where I see concerns from folks is, oh, are we going to hold up returns for another month by being able to do the right reviews? No, the whole point of analytics is actually being able to weed through all of that and get you to the right things much more quickly. And in the last report that came out from TIGTA, which is the Inspector General that oversees them, they noted that over 6 million returns were denied for identity theft alone. That was a huge increase over what they'd been seeing previously, which actually was to the tune of multi-billion dollars. Definitely still places to go, still a lot of room for opportunity there. They are also running an entire parallel version of that offline to be able to look at how they can improve analytics. So here's the ones that we're really running on the returns today, but we're also copying all that data offline to be able to test and try to improve the analytics moving forward. And just a coming full circle, a quick little piece off of my own work within Washington State. There, and again, we had some of this data sharing was already in place. Some of it was came through law changes that were part of that joint legislative task force on the underground economy. We're able to use data sets from 5 different agencies, 15 programs, along with the IRS in one place. It took us, we saw an 80% decrease in the amount of time to review a tax return. So huge improvement just by that. 50% increase in dollars identified for each one of our audits, and an 80% decrease in false positives, along with a very significant positive ROI, about 30-1 when you look at it over the course of a 5-year period. So for myself, it was following down that same path in small steps to get to this point to really be able to say it's the right thing to do, and it's a way to improve over top of everything else you're doing. So with that, That's the end of the prepared remarks that I had. Definitely want to make myself available to any and all of the committee for any questions.
Questions, comments? Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being in and out of it. When you were talking about the IRS level stuff, I wondered if you have any thoughts, and I apologize if you covered this, about the impact that this significant new tax package might have on your ability to run those kind of analytics. Like, do you expect kind of it'll be a year or two of getting through it in the first place to start refiguring out what is the norm and what the analytics should look for on the, you know, on the deviation from the norm or what have you?
So thank you, Chair Barnhart and Representative Smith Warner, for the question. So I think the answer to that is yes and no. So on some of those pieces in particular, one of the big areas of focus for the IRS right now was that idea of how do we stop the money from going out the door, as opposed to who do we audit? And I think that the stopping the money going out the door, which is a lot about the identity theft, the tax code changes aren't going to change that one bit. It'll change how that return looks, but it won't change the scheme. It won't change the nature of it. It won't change that idea of looking at it year over year and being able to find those problems as you know you've become an anomaly to yourself. So I think that part will still keep running quite well. But yes, what's funny is every time I look at tax law, I look at the loopholes immediately. I can't help it. It's my background. And so I start to say, oh, here, and are where the next schemes are going to come from that will be the people just trying to cheat on their own returns. So this idea of the difference between I'm trying to underpay what I owe or I'm trying to scheme my life in a way that looks differently than it really is versus I'm just a fraudster that's stolen identities and I'm committing theft around that. I think that that latter one, people are already working on what the new loopholes look like, but it will take a year or two, and it will definitely take a year or two to really understand what significant outliers look like. Mm-hmm. You know, we're bringing in and losing completely new sources of revenue around it. A lot of the changes won't make a big difference. I mean, the corporate tax rate, and you know, which is huge in terms of dollars, but it's not going to make a significant change. It'll change some legitimate behavior, but I don't think that's going to change a whole lot around what they would be looking for from a return perspective.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh, please.
So these are you're presenting very different tax systems. I mean, Washington State, it's clearly not an income tax.
Right, and North Carolina So Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, yes. Part of it is I did want to give my own background, and yes, to say that is business taxes, that kind of stuff. We were using the business occupation tax, which is a top line business revenue tax, is one of the things that's in there. So it's different from income tax, but looks at the top line number rather than top line plus deductions. However, all the other states that I've worked in, every single one, they're all income tax. The IRS, all the other stuff. So typically, now, often they have a sales tax component as well. Sometimes we did work with that. Sometimes we didn't do work with that.
Follow-up question. Do you find any different levels of fraud associated with different taxing systems?
Representative Warnhart, Representative Marsh. So, yes. A lot of that has to do with the complexity of the mechanism. So the more that you add complexity to any sort of mechanism, the easier it is to either just legitimately do it incorrectly, which, believe me, I saw plenty of that even as I worked with businesses, and also to purposely work to game the system. So in every state that I've seen, there's some very complex sets of offsets and counterpoints when you come to income taxes, whether it's on the individual side or the business side. And so I've seen some of those that have lended themselves more to concerns and gaming than others. Do I just overall see a higher percentage of cheating in one tax versus another? Not necessarily. I mean, there's definitely some differences, but it's really more state to state around the laws rather than tax type to tax type, mm-hmm. in my experience. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Representative Finley.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I was curious, if all the data is housed at the Department of Revenue, what statutory issues have you encountered in the past that would need to be addressed to allow some analytical work to begin on that? I mean, I know you're not familiar with ours specifically, but mm-hmm. in general, what would be some limitations if the data is mostly all housed there?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Finley. There shouldn't be any statutory limitations. There truly shouldn't. About the only thing that I've ever seen is really the question of how they want to implement analytics, if they want to do it on site, if they want to host it at a data center, if they want to do it, you know, these days now you're getting more software as a service, platform as a service. So that's where I see different states going to different places is, oh, we don't feel any of our data can be hosted. Oh, we want all of our data hosted. So it's more of that push and pull that I'm seeing in like that's very much happening live all over the country, and I watch states go different directions on it. But if the data is already within the Department of Revenue, there's absolutely nothing that is restricting this, and there's nothing restricting using the IRS data that they're shared with as part of these systems.
Thank you.
The Department of Revenue, in the process of its most recent computer update, has worked very closely with the state chief information officer, and I would expect them to continue to do that on the topic you just raised. I mean, how much of it do we keep here? How much of it goes into a backup system that's carefully encrypted? How much goes into a second backup system in case we lose the first one? All of those things fall within the purview of the CIO. Mm-hmm. But the department follows along pretty carefully on that because we insist on it.
And that's very well said, Chair Barnhart. I've truly seen places go completely different directions. So the IRS has determined that everything is going to be on site. Mm-hmm. And so even when I had to work with them, when I had to do training, you know, so I go there for training, go there to do the work. Everything's done on site. Nothing is hosted. North Carolina, one of the examples I gave, all of that's hosted. Their entire analytics center is hosted. That's because that's the route they wanted to go, and they found that it's the quickest and easiest to keep adding another data set, but they put out the legal structure ahead of time on how that was going to work. Now, it's also changed where it was located. Originally, you know, it's that battle over, well, where does something like that land? So originally it was under the comptroller's office. Now it's under the state CIO. You know, so trying to figure out where those things land. California very much wants things still on site along with some backups. Tennessee is great with hosting. So, you know, I think that's going to continue over the next decade or so as we figure out what does staffing look like? Mm-hmm. What does the state look like? Do we want big data centers? You know, Washington State built a huge data center right as that concept went away. You know, so, you know, really thinking about investments and what makes sense and what's protected, you're right on. I mean, you're definitely thinking about the right things there.
Well, you also have to pay attention to where the expertise is on security, for example, mm-hmm. and the potentiality of being hacked. As some states probably don't have much capacity in that area, and they need to hire it. And they'd better. And hiring it may mean that you host it.
Again, very, very well said, Chair Barnhart. You are correct that, you know, having been part of a public system and knowing who and what you can and can't hire and what you can pay for that, sometimes those are the barriers. And that may be why certain states are getting the point to say, we can't find these people, we can't pay these people, and even if we can, the second they get experience, they're gone. Mm-hmm. Maybe we truly just need to find the people that are experts and make sure to lock them in and do very well with that.
I had a different set of questions.
Of course.
You used an example from individual tax return. We don't need to go back to it.
Okay.
You also indicated that you spend most of your work dealing with business issues or issues involving business returns. Can you give us a sense of where the both the number of fraudulent or seriously misstated returns are that are not accidents but seem to be intentional? Is it a whole bunch of $300 items, or is it a few multi-$1 million items, or is it both?
So, Chair Barnhart, thank you for the question. It's both, but these days it's very much a whole lot of low numbers. So honestly, that was part of the scheme between identity theft and learning. So again, thinking back to rules-based systems. So one of the things is that if it's low dollars, if you find the right threshold, the state will never look at it. And every state has a different threshold and they change it, but they'll test it. And you can find out, oh, so you stop at $299. Oh, now you stop at $173. I don't care what it is. I'll keep testing the system. And then the second I find that threshold, I'll throw 30,000 of those through that, knowing you won't look at it at all. And now it adds up. And the problem there, compared to traditional audits, is there's no one to go after.
Right.
It wasn't Carl Hammersberg committing fraud on his return, and you know where to find me, and you know I have a W-2, and you can garnish my wages, and you can find that kind of stuff. Like, yes, we still have to look at those. But it's, in fact, no, this was a scheme, and the people are out of state, or they're out of country. The money went, the money's gone, and you're never going to get it back. And that's actually one of the things that the IRS was struggling with, is to say, well, technically every one of those is a criminal case, and they have a whole criminal division.
That's right.
And then you realize, I can't run 6 million criminal cases, or even if it's one person that filed 1,000, I don't have the resources to go after all these criminally, and I may not even be able to touch them because they're out of country. So for them, really the idea was, how do we run the analytics well enough to stop these? And sometimes they don't even deny the return. One of the best approaches on some of these, because they're all coming in electronically, is they pend the return and send an email contact back asking additional questions. That costs nothing. 96% of the time when they did that, the request, there you go, they disappear completely, it's off into the ether, and out of the remaining 4%, about half actually answer the questions and turns out they were just really bad at filing their returns, they're completely legitimate, and then about half are bold enough to still keep going, and then those are the ones that they start to treat as a true, okay, they're around, they're gonna continue this, maybe we'll treat this as a criminal operation.
Do you collect IP addresses?
Yeah, that's what I was
saying. So, yes, so IP addresses is one of the things that we definitely look at around all of this.
I mean, if it's an electronically filed return,
yes,
they have to come from somewhere.
That is correct. And so that is a place where SAS is actually done. So a lot of states are already looking at IP addresses. So a couple of things they're looking at is specific sort of known bad, let's say, so if your email is at Gmail or at Yahoo, there's some other ones that are at, and they're very questionable. So you kind of identify, here's entire areas where almost everything's going to be questionable, and so they start to look at those returns more. Also looking at how many things are being filed from out of state or how many things are being filed from out of country, what they look like. What I have found is that we have a different way of looking at that than some of the simple versions, and we've been able to give a good 25% lift over and above what states were already doing just around IP addresses to really understand, like, no, that didn't come from where you thought it came from. Actually going back into the header information and those kinds of things and looking for spoofed IP addresses and that sort of stuff. So there's definitely a lot of value that can be had in that as well. Again, that's just do the analytics, stop the door.
And I assume you know what the VPN IP addresses are, and those are red flags immediately.
So, Chair Barnhart, VPN, yes and no. I mean, if it's looking very much like an attempt to appear that you're from a different location, a different country, mm-hmm. then yes, that could be definitely a red flag. I think you may start to see more use of VPNs.
Legitimately.
From legitimate people.
That's true.
As you start to see, again, as these risks climb to all of us,
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't gone there yet. I only used the one for my corporate version, so I'm always in the SAS VPN, but that's certainly not where I'm filing my taxes from.
No, that's right. We could go on and on. Are there other questions? This is a fascinating discussion.
It is.
Yeah. I really appreciate your bringing us up to date. We are always interested in what the department is doing and how it's kind of proceeding on the process of making the tax system better. Mm-hmm. I particularly appreciate the reduction in the false positives, because when you get a false positive and you go out with a question or an accusation, you disrupt somebody's sleep for no good reason. And they have that much less reason to believe, to trust you in the future, or to acknowledge that the state is doing a good job in managing its revenues. And so reducing false positives not only is an efficiency measure, it seems to me, for the state, but it also is a way of improving the reputation of the department as it collects the revenue that we have to have in order to pay for schools, health care, and public safety. Anything else? Appreciate your coming today and
Absolutely.
Giving this presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair Barnhart,
for having
members
us.
Of the committee. Appreciate it.
Dave, did you have something? No? All right. Committee, thank you very much. I think this will be our last meeting of the year. Hopefully it's the year. If we meet again this year, it'll be because we have a special session, not because something really important has happened. Thank you so much. And with that, committee is adjourned.